Let's continue here because I just have one more page. Alright, so it says, because no two metals have the same anodic, I hate that word, anodic, because I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, anodic index value, there's a question, won't there always be some corrosion when there is contact between dissimilar metals? So let me just read this again. Because no two metals have the same anodic index values, won't there always be some corrosion when there is contact between dissimilar metals? And that answer is yes. The answer is yes, because there will always be some corrosion. But very small differences in anodic indexes result in very slow corrosion. So that's the key. You know, things will corrode because you got two different types of metals, but over a very slow and long period of time. That time, I'm not sure of, but I'm sure we've seen it. It also is determined and dependent on the environment that it's in. As Roy just mentioned, you know, if you don't have any air, if it's in a vacuum, your corrosion may not even exist because air has a certain index of humidity, there's a certain moisture in the air, and air itself. So that adds to the rate and change of how fast it's going to corrode. So being that antennas are mostly outdoors, you are subject to all the conditions of the weather. Hot, cold, you know, temperature, humidity, atmospheric pressure, and which of course exists, and so on. So, I'm just summarizing this. It says if the environment is harsh, such as exposed to the weather or salt is another one. If you notice that people who live down by the ocean, you put an antenna up, you put an aluminum antenna up, leave it there for a number of years, what are you going to see? With all that salt moisture in the air, what are you going to see with your aluminum? Oh. And really, here's something, I've experienced that, even away from the ocean itself, but not that far away, but away from it, that my aluminum a Cushcraft antenna actually corroded where there was nothing left. It actually broke the matching device in the bottom of the antenna, which is an aluminum rod, corroded to such a point it disconnected itself and there was nothing left. It was gone. Roy?
Yeah, water corrodes. Salt water corrodes much more rapidly because it allows the electrons to travel quicker and eat away at the aluminum. I mean, in normal circumstances, if you don't tempt aluminum, it develops a very fine insulating oxide that on its surface, which is protective. But if you expose it to just too much salt water and such, it'll eat through the fabric and produce just a bunch of glorified aluminum oxide, which makes a great type of sand for polishing things, but not good for structure at all.
YDY, comment?
Yeah, Hank, so the question I ask is, how come they still make, like Cushcraft, for example, and maybe other antenna manufacturers make their antennas out of aluminum, you know, other than the weight factor, you know, lightweight? Because if you put an antenna up and you live right on the ocean, just a few houses away of the ocean right there with the salt water and everything else, the question I always ask is, how long is that going to last? I guess you'll be surprised. I mean, it may not last as long as you think. Hank, go ahead.
Yeah, N1YDY. When I lived on the boat in Miami, I had a Gap Challenger. And the Gap Corporation was up in Vero Beach, Florida, so they were very familiar with corrosion in saltwater environments. and they actually had a different hardware kit for antennas that were going to be put up in a saltwater environment. It had aluminum screws rather than stainless, and the top of the antenna was actually ventilated. There was a cap that was designed and routed, and it looked pretty on most of the antennas, but on the ones that they were putting up in a saltwater environment, they put up these open antennas that allowed air to ventilate right through them. They were open on the bottom and open on the top. N1, Whitey White.
Okay, yeah, GAP's made antennas for quite a while, and they make that GAP Titan, the GAP Challenger, the GAP Eagle, and I forgot that they were down in Florida, yeah. I've seen antennas, by the way, that have corroded quicker because of the environment due to the fact that they're right on the coast, you know, they're right there at the shorefront, and they're subject to the salt water spray and everything else. So that could that could cause a lot of damage.
Had a different capacitor kit for the ones that were going to be mounted in the water or over the water. They didn't charge any more for this, and they actually told me that it was weaker than the standard hardware kit, but apparently held up a little longer in the salt water environment. And one more UI.
Okay, very good. Yeah, thanks. That's interesting. Could come up with different types of hardware to reduce the effects. Okay, so as I said, you know, the salt water and spray, depending on the exposure to it, will cause the an odic index, and they have a number here. Let me just go back just one sentence here. So, it says, and I just am repeating it, it says, if the environment is harsh, such as exposed to the weather or salt spray, it will limit the difference in an odic index to a number of 0.15 volts, that's really 150 millivolts or less, means the corrosion will be manageable. In normal conditions, you can get up to 0.25 volts, which is 250 millivolts, by the way. It's 0.25. You can get 0.25 volt difference can be tolerated. Now that it says this can be discussed in more detail at, and if Roy, if you want to write this down, if anybody wants to know, it's at corrosion-doctors. thecorrosiondoctors.org /definitions/galvanic-series.htm. And that's the file. So I'll just repeat that. It's, if you want to hear what the actual voltages are in difference, if you want to make measurements, it's discussed in detail at corrosion-doctors, that's /definitions/galvanic-series.htm. Okay, you got that, Roy? Just for information.
Are you sure that's a dash and not a dot at the HTM?
Did I say dash? It's series.htm. Did I say dash? I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'll look it up and I'll put it up on the link page.
It actually looks like a dash. The lighting here isn't that good. It's really small lighting, so it is a dot. It makes sense it would be a dot, because anything would be .htm or dot whatever. Okay. Not yet. Let me just see here. So the next thing, connecting to galvanized surfaces. All right, so here we're going to go into something that's used in batteries. Because zinc is an extremely active material, which is why it is so effective in protecting steel and iron. Connecting copper wire to bronze clamps directly to a galvanized surface creates a very strong corrosion potential. So, what should you do? So, again, because zinc is an extremely active material, which is why it is so effective in protecting steel, which we know, and iron. Connecting copper wire to bronze clamps. Now, think about it. You're going to connect a copper wire to a bronze clamp directly to a galvanized surface creates a very strong corrosion potential. And what should you do about that? Okay, so here's some answers. Although, and I've seen these, there are some anti-corrosion compounds, continuous exposure to weather will eventually wash them away. Instead, an inexpensive method of protecting the connection is to place a thin piece of 300 series stainless steel. Now, stainless steel doesn't corrode, at least to my knowledge. Or if it does, I don't see it. A piece of 300 series stainless steel between the galvanized surface and the clamp of wire. 24 gauge, which is equivalent to 0.025, that's, 25 thousandths of an inch, shim stock is sufficient and acts to slow down the corrosion process while maintaining good electrical connectivity for lightning protection and RF connections. So there's something that you guys can do, and if you get a thin piece of 300 series stainless steel and just wrap it around it between the galvanized surface and the clamp or wire, and use it as a little shim stock, is sufficient and acts to slow down. So they have a little protective insulating device right there. What do you think of that, Roy? That's pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea. I mean, if you go to places like DX Engineering, they're still selling those pastes. Basically, there's oil with little pieces of different types of metal shavings floating in the material.
Yeah, I've seen that in that catalog, that being sold. Very good. This is WA2CDO, Ladies Corner, and we're almost completed with this part. Okay, so let's see. As I act to slow down the corrosion process while maintaining case. And they show a figure. Figure one shows a photo of a ground clamp on a galvanized tower leg with a shim between the clamp and the leg. Thin shim can be cut with heavy scissors and bent by hand. Another option, by the way, is to use a tower leg clamp designed specifically for this application, such as a Rhone. Rhone actually makes this. It's the R-CPC1/1.25. That's the part number available from several vendors. So Rhone actually makes a clamp that would work on that galvanized material of your towel. All right, some areas have corrosive soils, and other environmental characteristics can make corrosion from an ongoing issue with towers. There's an article, I've got to look this up, Tony Fisher, K1KP, Kilo One, Kilo Papa. He has an article in the October 2010 issue of QST. Is your tower still safe? And that's another interesting article we could maybe talk about towers. Discusses setting up a specific setting up a sacrificial anode system that will protect your tower from, let's see what it says here. Okay, so that makes sense. It'll prevent. So he has an article on how you protect your tower from corrosion, because you don't want your tower to fall down. Okay, and of course you can also check with local contractors to see if corrosion is a special problem in your area. Now that takes care of that discussion as a basic foundation. Now they do show here, there's a little article on how to make your own galvanic cell, and there's a talk about, and they show a little description, a saltwater galvanic cell. It's actually showing a voltage of 0.55 volts, that they have a volt difference in potential. That's a, you know, difference in potential is the voltage between a copper wire and an aluminum rod that's immersed in a salt water solution. So depending on the type of materials that you want to use, they show here stainless steel will give you a different voltage. Let's see another one. The voltage right was 0.8, what does that say, 0.805 volts. So depending on the type of material that you would merge into the salt water solution will determine what voltage you're going to see. And you could actually make one and play around with it. So they talk about that. But basically that's it. For the discussion of corrosion, so you got a basic idea of how it's formed, what causes it, and how to prevent it. So there you go with that. And I see it's 20 after 9, so the timing's about right for me anyway, since I do have to go to work tomorrow. Roy, you can add any of this that I just mentioned. And I think it's an interesting discussion, because we've always seen articles on this. And by the way, they do show, figure one is a 300 series stainless steel shim between a bronze ground clamp and a galvanized tower leg, protects the zinc layer and the clamp. So, you know, normally you wouldn't think of these things. You would just take the clamp, put it around, because you want to attach a wire to a clamp. You take that bronze clamp, you put it around the galvanized leg of the tower, and you think that that's okay, but it's not. So now you put this stainless steel shim between it, and you'll prevent any corrosion from occurring. So that's a good thing to know. Good article on that. Thanks, Roy. Anything you want to add, go ahead. This is WA2CD, Landy's Corner.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. That was a very interesting discussion, deep to my heart. I was a chemistry major in college, so redox reactions and such are the basis of the batteries that we know and love. Instead of the electrons traveling in solution, we force them down a conducting medium that we call a wire, and we run all this fun equipment to talk on the radio with them. So it's always good to hear a little bit more chemistry. If anyone else has any kind of questions on this particular subject or anything related to the subject, you know, you could ask it now. Okay, I guess galvanic corrosion by dissimilar metals has been talked out of you all. So I thank you, Andy, for the discussion. Like I said, I never want to miss any kind of a chemistry-related discussion, and this is a marriage between chemistry and amateur radio, so I thank you very much, and I look forward to next week's episode. Let's get back to our list. I hope that the people are still there and they still have their questions. Craig, KD2OGB, what's your question tonight?
32. 2OGB. Roy, I'm having a very hard time keeping my eyes open right now.
Well, Craig, it's up to you. If you want to pass for tonight, that's okay.
I'll see if I can get ahead for next Sunday. Sorry.
It's okay, Craig. Don't worry about it. Go to sleep. Rest up. Rob, KD2UQK, do you have a question tonight?
Yes, Roy, I did, actually. It's on, this is KD2UQK. It's actually on wireless charging. I was wondering if you had any insight into how that worked, Roy, because I don't know if the technology is necessarily publicly, not accessible, but publicly buildable. I was wondering if I could make some sort of an IP water-resistant sealed type of battery enclosure that I could charge wirelessly. It's a wild thought, but I don't really know outside of very specific applications, if it's readily usable or available. I just wanted to get your 2 cents on it.
Okay, there's a few of them. There's a few different non-compatible technologies for wireless power. The underlying premise is relatively simple. It's to inductively couple an alternating power supply with a similar inductor, and through inductive coupling, you put the power into the secondary circuit. The problem is that all these different technologies also incorporate very specific control chips, so that although you could use a generic Kai charger, if you want to charge up your own battery pack, you would have to go see if the chipset that is used for it is available for, buying in lots of one instead of 10,000. And then theoretically, you could just take some enameled wire, I would assume, and wind it a lot of turns. I would, again, Google to find out if anyone did this experimentally. My guess is if the chipset is available anywhere, there's got to be people who have done it. So it's possible to do. It's just a matter of probably the most difficult step is getting the proper chipset for the technology. Yeah, I couldn't make out your call sign. You want to try again? I'm sorry, that's about 95% noise. Any way you can kind of wiggle the antenna a little bit or kick up the gain? Our repeater doesn't have the sensitivity it once had. Well, hopefully that person is figuring out a better way to get into the repeater. My surmise is he has some expertise or experience or greater knowledge in it, but... Rob, did you get what I was trying to say about looking up? Well, number one, Google the subject, because that's always good, and then see if you can obtain some chips to play around with. The actual coil shouldn't be that much of a problem, as long as you find out how many loops and what diameter would be best and what have you, according to the Kai charge or the charge that you decide upon technology's technical specs. I assume some of these things are patented, so that's available as well.
Wireless charging, but I guess it's not really feasible at this point in time just yet. All right, Roy, I appreciate it. KD2UQK.
V2VAV trying again with a real antenna.
Congratulations, Ed. I now hear you. What do you have to add to this discussion?
I don't have much experience with these, but I did see one once that appeared to me you had a transformer where the primary was wound on a section of core and coated in waterproof plastic that fit into the secondary are also coated in waterproof plastic, but what would happen was the two cores together, in a way reminiscent of bringing stuff together in an atomic bomb, which is a terrible analogy. And the idea is the two cores have relatively thin protection. When you put them together, you're basically making a transformer core.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Ed. It's inductive coupling. So the power source is an alternating current plus a control chip, and it sends a handshake to the other device, which gains power from the inductive coupling. And once they shake hands and self-identify to each other, one part pours the RF into the coil, and the other one drinks it up.
Unnecessarily complicated. Let me be. I think you are basically building a standard transformer. And as long as you get a decent voltage and power level at the secondary, it just becomes a classic power supply, linear power supply problem. There is no handshaking involved any more than you have with the boat anchor power supply.
Well, as I mentioned before, there's a bunch of different technologies. The one that I'm familiar with is, I think it's QUI, they pronounce it Chai. It has definite handshaking because I have Apple products, and when you put it next to the inductor, it doesn't just kind of light up and charge. It does a little song and a little dance. And a little seltzer under its pants. So there's definitely some kind of logic code handshaking that's confirming that it's a proper Chi charger as opposed to just a random RF field that the induction loop is picking up. So in some cases, it might be just a vanilla transformer. But in the ones that I have seen, I think there's a control chip and there's handshaking going on.
Well, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Every approach has its benefits and its weaknesses, and what I'm proposing is cheap and dirty. What you're proposing is very elaborate and probably much more efficient and at a tremendous cost and technology requirement.
Well, yeah, but the problem is that, well, it would be more efficient to control the flow of electricity in the transmitting coil, and that's probably part of the job of the control chip, and also recognizing the other side is prepared to take the amount of current that the coil is going to supply it with. I mean, so the point that I was trying to make out is that, not that I don't think that Rob wants to do it from scratch. I guess theoretically he could. He could build a high-frequency oscillating circuit and an inductive coil and put another inductive coil on his battery pack and a diode to turn it into DC, and if he got the voltages okay, it might work. I was thinking more of, just buying the chipset off of eBay and then just following the general recommendations for that technology. Those chips probably, if they're available, are dirt cheap because they put them in almost everything these days.
Quick follow-up, Roy, UQK.
Yes, Rob.
Yeah, that's more what I was inclined to do, just because I don't really have the equipment or, the technical know-how to build a breadboard or a coil from scratch. I get the premise, it's just a wire you wrap, but yeah, that's what I was more inclined to do, kind of buy the parts and kind of chop it together. But I do get, I'm sorry, I forgot your name on the other end, but I do get what he's saying, where you do it cheap and dirty, where you just, without any real protocol involved, you just have the two halves of a transformer and you're just inducting it into the other half. I do get that, and that works too, but that involves me being a little bit more handy, and I don't know if I necessarily have the means to do that at this moment. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, yeah, I could understand it. I mean, it works all different ways. It's more if you like to tinker. If you like to tinker, that's an interesting thing to do. And like I said, you can Google it. There's got to be guys who've done this before, and there's probably YouTubes. And, you know, even if you don't want to go to the trouble, you might be interested to see how these people's solution worked out. I mean, I'm kind of a lazy good-for-nothing. I would probably just plug it in through the wire and spare myself all the exercise and such, but in the old days I probably would have gone the other way.
Give him more comments.
Yes, Ed.
Item one: if you're going to start breadboarding stuff with chipsets you buy from eBay, doing that without A, an oscilloscope, B, familiarity with how to use it, and C, the time and desire to do it, would be an exercise in absolute frustration. All right, second item. You brought up something, Roy, that I was about to say. Why exactly go this way? What is the benefit over hardwired to make it worth all the aggravation and guarantee low efficiency?
Okay, I'll throw it over to Rob. I think the ultimate answer is because it's a neat thing to try, but I won't speak for Rob.
Well, I'll tell you what. The need is definitely yes, because it's a cool thing. And Ed, that's your name. Thank you for chiming in. Yes, the point was to have a totally waterproof box where I wouldn't have any exposed connections on the outside. I get the point where you can just put a rubber grommet over it and call it a day, right? But, you know, I would almost want this thing, because the idea was to take this out on a boat or a jet ski and not have to worry about any sort of saltwater ingress. But, you know, then that comes up with the argument of just don't be an idiot and don't put it where it gets wet, you know. But the idea was to keep it totally waterproof. But then, you know, as I'm thinking about it, there might be ventilation for the batteries I would have to take into consideration. Maybe it's not the best idea.
On a jet ski, there is no AC power available. You have to bring the batteries. And I would think it would be a very poor idea to distract yourself on a jet ski, and there's always the possibility of going in the drink with it.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's why it's not sounding so hot anymore.
All right, can I go out on a limb here, Roy?
Feel free, Ed.
Rob, I have been doing this for millennia. I mean, this has been my life. It sounds like a fascinating thing for me to play with and learn. But there are thousands and thousands of good introductory projects. If I don't see how to do it with all my experience under my belt, I really don't think it's a good starter project.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, Ed. That certainly makes sense. You know, by far be it from me. I've only had my license since September, and you know, I'm not the most well versed in electronics, but I see what you mean. If I had an oscilloscope and a whole setup where I could actually do some real testing instead of just slapping something together with some duct tape and zip ties, that might be the way to go. But yeah, I think I'll stick to the wire and just throw out the wireless idea. Thank you guys for helping out, Ed and Roy. Always fantastic. Always a fascinating net. Back over to you, Roy.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for participating. You know, I always love when we're able to help people along. I feel a little bit bad killing your planned experiment. I'm sure you'll come up with a bunch of other things that you'd like to try out. And again, Google is your friend. YouTube is your friend. You might if you have a clever idea, you Google it and see if someone had a similar clever idea and take a look and how it worked for them as well. Certainly, Ed.
I do not want Rob to come away from this that I'm a curmudgeon and I'm a naysayer. I am more than willing to help. On the other hand, a man's got to know his limitations, and I think this is a bridge too far.
Okay, that's understandable, Ed. I mean, you know, some guys out there, when the Wright brothers told people that they were going to fly, there were people who said that that's a little bit too far. Most of the times, those people were quite right. 99.9999% of the time, they're quite right. Every so often, just to screw around with the universe, they're wrong. But I understand yours is the voice of wisdom. And having tried many of these things, or versions of these things.
By the way, about the Wright brothers, here's a, ready for a trivia quiz?
Sure.
What did the Wright brothers invent that was earth-shaking?
I don't know. It probably actually had to do more with a bicycle than a plane. What was it?
There were lots of people trying to invent planes along with the Wright brothers. What the Wright brothers did that was earth-shaking that led to the invention of the flying, working airplane was the wind tunnel. So they should build small models, build a model, test it, see what they did wrong, go on to the next one in days rather than months. And that made the invention of the airplane just a matter of how many tries does it take before you get it right in the wind tunnel.
Okay, so they actually put it through a wind tunnel? Because the footage that I seem to remember in the back of my head doesn't have anything that looks like a wind tunnel. And by the way, David, I think you said whiteout? That was Betty Nesmith Graham who invented whiteout. It was back in... I don't know. Something like 1940 or something.
Yeah, it was the Wright brothers. They invented whiteout. But Mike Nesmith's mother took credit for it.
Okay, never heard that one before. I'll have to look into it.
Roy, I don't know if you understood what I was talking about with the wind tunnel and its benefits.
Probably not. Could you rephrase it for me? Because it sounded like they used wind tunnels, and the thing that kind of annoys me is I don't have any memory of them being photographed playing around with wind tunnels.
Of course not. That was their proprietary business secret. Why would they release that? The Wright brothers were very proprietary. The reason why the U.S. did not have any American-made airplanes in World War I was because the Wright brothers were so obsessive about secrecy of their designs. But coming back to it, what it was, what they were doing is somebody had an idea. He spent months and months and months building up an airplane and trying it. If he survived the first test flight, he'd realize what he did wrong and spend another 6 months tweaking or building a new model. By building a wind tunnel where you can test models, you can try a model, see how it goes in the airflow, and even if you've really been a mess of it, you're not going to kill yourself at least. And then you tweak it and you adjust it. Sometimes you can do several tweaks in a day. You can build a whole new model in a few days. So incredibly accelerated their design. then when they were happy with what they had in the boat, in the tunnel, they scaled it up to life size and flew it.
Oh, okay. So it was kind of their secret test equipment that they didn't really talk about. They just, once they figured it out in the wind tunnel, they took the plane out there and gave it a spin on the field.
It involved taking a 1 foot model and building it up to a 30-foot model.
Okay, that's interesting. I've studied a great deal about the history of aviation, but I don't recall hearing these particular stories. You know, usually they just trot out the film stock and show you the usual stuff. So that's interesting.
Yeah, the film stock, that was their advertisement. The other stuff was their secret sauce.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I've picked up little bits and pieces. The Wright brothers were a curious the duo. I don't believe they got married. They were really, really obsessed with inventing stuff. So I guess that's an important thing. And, you know, they probably didn't have quite the most pleasant life, or maybe they enjoyed it. I don't know. Who would have thunk it 50 years earlier that man would fly?
Well, I think back in those days, it was easier to invent things and be able to get a patent and, you know, you would get some kind of financial backing. Now it's like virtually impossible, you know, to get financial backing for any project, you know. And most companies just aren't interested in new inventions.
Well, they're not interested in other people's inventions. They're interested in their own inventions. There are inventions, there are patents that are being made as we speak. Matter of fact, prior to the Wright brothers, back in the 1800s, the patent office required you to send them a scale model to prove the concept. So you couldn't just kind of draw out these vague plans and say, and then you push the button and it's a time machine. Whereas now you can make up almost anything as long as it doesn't have the word perpetual motion or infinite energy. And as long as it isn't a copy of someone else's, it could be complete gibberish, and you, too, can have a patent on it. So, you know, it's not that difficult to get a patent. You have to pay a patent lawyer and do patent searches and such, and you have to stay away from a couple of key phrases, but otherwise you can do it. Getting some company to buy your patent, that's another thing entirely.
Well, a company makes the most profit, you know. The inventor these days gets virtually nothing. So, you know, you might as well just give it away for free.
It depends upon your abilities. Some inventors are excellent businessmen. And so not only do they invent, but they profit. The Dyson, the gentleman who makes the overpriced vacuums and other gadgets of the modern age, is making a load of money off of his inventions, whereas other people who, you know, their inventions either aren't quite that useful or they don't have too much business sense, don't make any money. We've talked in the past about Edwin Armstrong, a brilliant electronic engineer. He invented super heterodyne circuits, super regenerative circuits, FM modulation. I mean, he should have owned the place, but because of litigious people and bad business decisions, he took a gainer out of his window instead.
Yeah,
Yeah, you doubled with Ed. Ed, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think I have something to add on this. I have worked on a number of projects that have been patented. And what usually happens is a company a customer who they dealt with in the past comes to them and says, you know, I have this crazy idea. I have no idea how to do it. There doesn't seem to be anybody around who makes it. You think you can look into it and maybe see if you might possibly be interested in pursuing this? And if you can, we'd be interested in buying it. And that's when the company starts bringing together a team of its, as somebody once put it, the guys you keep locked in the back room, to which my friend and I once said one of these times, so he just said, hey, that's us. And you get everybody together and you kick around ideas and you see if, you know, this is feasible, and then you start putting some stuff together, and sometimes it turns out into a real product. And I've been involved in a number of those.
Yeah, that's very, very common, that in-house companies are much more interested in doing that. They have problems buying, partial rights to an external patent. They don't want to involve themselves in strangers. So if they can keep it in the family, that's their preferred way. But, you know, you'll also occasionally hear these terrible stories of a guy coming up to the company he works with and saying, you know, I think I can figure out how to make blue LEDs. And they said, well, we really don't think you can, and it would probably take too much effort and cost too much research. So no, go back and do what you were doing before. So the guy would go off and secretly do his work on his blue LEDs, discover how to make them, and give Nietzsche a $1 billion-plus dollars of profit, in which I think they turned around, they gave this poor schnook about a $2,000 award for all that. So, you know, sometimes it bends over and kicks you.
Yeah, I think that inventing things is not profitable, it's not lucrative enough. And I think it's just better to be as useful as you can to your fellow man.
Well, once again, it depends who you are and what you got. If you're Dyson, he's making a very nice living over there in the United Kingdom. So I think he would disagree with you. If you are a tinkerer and you're interested in coming up with things that no one else has, it's a crapshoot. It's not a sure thing. It's far, far from a sure thing. But occasionally, you might turn a profit. You might be the guy who invents Silly Putty or the pet rock or what have you.
Yeah, but, you know, I could give it away and be useful without anything in particular to prove at all and say, well, you know, I'm giving something. I'm adding something to somebody's life. You know, right time, right place, somebody wants certain kind of information, then I could maybe put a price tag on it.
Okay, and you're free to do that. People donate their intellectual property all the time. Other people try and monetize it as much as humanly possible, and other people somewhere in the middle. Unfortunately, as I've mentioned before, the biggest deciding factor is business expertise of the inventor. If he has none and he trusts people, that's usually a bad combination. But, you know, it's a free country. You can give away your stuff or you can charge for it if people are willing to pay you for it. So, you know, everyone makes their own choices in this.
I'm not in the business of radio, electronics, telecommunications. I don't really know enough about it, you know, to make some kind of big living at it. I'm an artist, and I make artwork. That's what I do. So, you know, I'm totally happy with that, you know, and I'm very thankful. KG2RY.
Have you ever considered going into non-fungible tokens?
What's that, Bitcoin?
No, that's the new nonsense where you You imprint a link to your electronic art, and you sell the unique token that's in Ethereum's blockchain for a lot of money. One guy sold just the NFT. It's just a data string for his works of electronic art for 5,000 days, and he received $69 million from someone out there.
Yeah, I read about that. Very interesting. I even saw a movie about the person who bought it. You know, he's a Bitcoin salesman, you know. I guess it's like all or nothing, all or nothing, all or nothing, you know. And he lives a very simple, his life. He doesn't have a big apartment. He doesn't have big possession, you know. And he said, I want to be the one to buy this artwork and be able to afford it. He's like a billionaire, guy from India. And I think that's like, I think it's mostly hype, and I think that it'll pass in time, you know, to sell a JPEG for $69 million, you know. And you can probably sell 500 more at $69 million if other people are willing to pay, you know. I say for art, you know, I like to have some substance to it, you know. A virtual product, maybe like a video.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically it could be any form of software. It's just a bit stream. And the weirdness of NFTs is this guy with $69 million does not actually own the copyright for the art. The artist still maintains possession of the copyright. He does not own a unique file of all of them. You can download the files all over the place. The only thing that he has is that non-fungible token that's generated by the cryptocurrency brand Ethereum. That's it. And for $69 million. So I don't know. Thankfully, he has more than enough money to lose. So I think he's going to lose a little along with gaining others from somewhere else.
Very good. You know, this kind of commerce is good for people who make artworks on computers, different kinds, you know, and it's all good, you know. And you can put the artwork in a token, you can put it on a keychain, you can download it, you can put it on a server. So many things that you can do with it. You know, if people are willing to buy, you know, then you know, I think that dictates what happens more than anything else.
Well, yeah, I mean, we live in a relatively free world. You can spend your money any way that you want. If the buyer and the seller come to an agreement and it's not some strange controlled substance or otherwise illegal, then everyone's free to spend money. If someone decides that your tissue box is worth $50 million to them, and they give you the $50 million and you give them the tissue box, then to me, that's a legitimate sale. It doesn't make any sense to me as a person, but what the hell? It's not important. I didn't buy it and I didn't sell it. So, you know, God bless America.
QSL, that and my Anytone ATD878UV, and the Nexteon 3.2-inch screen for my DMR reception. So, you know, you can't even make art out of those things.
Yes, I would agree. You could make art out of almost anything. By the way, did you know that Anytone now has an 878 UV Mark II?
QSL, I read about it. I read about it. 500,000 contacts. I don't know. There were some other things. it didn't seem to strike me as a big improvement. But, you know, they upgrade the firmware, then the HT can do more things.
Well, to my knowledge, there's only two things that changed. The Bluetooth module changed so that it now, in addition to doing digital APRS, it does analog APRS. And they changed the 1 gigabyte memory chip for a 2 gigabyte memory chip, doubling its contact list. So that's pretty much it as far as I know. APRS, analog, and twice as many contacts. The firmware, for all intents and purposes, can be upgraded on the old one as well as the new one. The only hardware difference that I'm aware of is those two things. So I was less than impressed when I found out what the Mark II meant.
KG2RY. Well, you know, I have to say the one that I have, it's below the plus, and since I don't have a Windows computer, I'm unable to upgrade the contact list and the firmware, so it's probably about 1 year behind.
Oh, that's a shame. You should find someone in the area that will let you use a laptop for, only about half an hour at most. Or you might want to invest in a very low-end Windows PC laptop, nothing particularly fancy, but gets the job done. You never know when you need these things.
Yeah, I know, but I have to say that whatever money I have, it stays in the bank. I have bills to pay. I have to upkeep. I have to buy food, so... the computer will have to wait.
Okay, that's why my first option was just find a local friend, a ham, an artist, who has a PC who wouldn't mind lending it to you for half an hour. There was someone else who you doubled over, that other person, you want to make a comment?
This is KD2VDW. I know Wayne's got a question, and he's waiting, so after him, I just had a comment.
Okay, very good, Mike. David, thanks for your participation, and I hope you figure out your problem. We did a little discussion in the chat room. There's a gentleman, KD2TNS, who's a software programmer. He thinks he might be able to give you some advice, so he's taken down your call sign, and maybe he'll send you some email on the subject as well.
Thank you, Roy. I appreciate it. Have a great night. KG2RY.
You too, David. Wayne, I hope we haven't kept you too long. KD2UDU, what's your question or comment for tonight?
Yeah, Roy, I'm sorry to interrupt. Mike and I were texting each other back and forth. I don't know how much time we have left. As you know, I like to tinker and do stuff, and I've been working on a 49-to-1 N-Fed transformer, auto transformer, which I wound around a core, a 240 toroid core. And subsequently, I watched a video from DX Engineering, and they were recommending that you use two cores and not one. And I was wondering if anybody had any experience just using one core and running about 100 watts, if that was going to be a problem.
Okay, anyone who builds their own balance, could you get by? Well, one of the important things to think of, Wayne, is what kind of transmissions are you planning to do? Because that could be a big difference.
Well, I was just limiting myself to sideband. I'm not proficient in Morse code yet, so I was not going to do any CW. So basically sideband, and that I was going to use that Kenwood, which Andy's still working on, but I'm hoping to get it back soon because he's got it transmitting, but there was some intermittent problems that he was trying to track down. So as I said, I was going to build an NFED half-wave antenna, 66 feet long wire, and that's what I was going to use this transformer for with the Kenwood, putting out about 150, maybe 125 watts.
Okay, Wayne. The reason why I asked you is what's very important is something called duty cycle. It's how often your transmitter is putting out all those watts. In something like FT8, data mode, it comes to almost 100% duty cycle at times. And, you know, things like FM is 100% duty cycle. But single sideband isn't. A lot of times I will be on my 10-meter net, and I will do peak power of 800 watts, and I'll look at the average power that I put out with the peak being 800, and it'll be below 70 watts. So averaging for single sideband is much more forgiving than for the digital mode. So I would tend to think that you might very